From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition, British veteran Eric Lomax. He was a POW held by the Japanese during World War II. He never quite recovered from the interrogations and torture. In recent years, he has found and forgiven the man who interrogated him. Eric Lomax's memoir is The Railway Man. Also, the life and times of Sam Cooke. Cooke's You Send Me went to number one in 1957. Cooke was murdered in 1964 at the age of 33. We'll hear an interview with Daniel Wolfe, author of a biography of Sam Cooke, and S.R. Crane, who founded the gospel quartet The Soul Stirrers, which launched Sam Cooke's recording career. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The death toll from Hurricane Fran is rising. Officials now blame at least 12 deaths on Fran, which has been downgraded to a tropical storm. The storm has caused considerable damage, especially to North Carolina. This morning, President Clinton declared the state a disaster area, making federal money available. The president spoke in Orlando to the National Baptist Convention USA, the largest black religious organization. He urged the delegates to pray for the victims of Fran.
We're going to do everything we can to help the people of North Carolina and South Carolina in this difficult time. But again, I say to you, here in Florida, those of you who went through Hurricane Andrew know what it's like. We need to be praying for those people and supporting them. And there are doubtless people here from those two states. In addition to the hurricane, there has been and will be more rain, and there's a lot to do.
On another subject, the president referred to some good news from Washington that the jobless rate is down. He called the statistic proof the economy is on the right track. What the unemployment rate did was to drop sharply to its lowest point in more than 7 years. NPR's John Itzde reports.
The Labor Department says the jobless rate in August declined to 5.1% from 5.4% in July. At the same time, the economy created 250,000 new non-farm payroll jobs. The report is further evidence that the economy remains strong, and it probably increases the likelihood that the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates when it meets September 24th. However, the Labor Department cautioned that today's data may overstate the strength in the job market because the government conducted the employment survey later in the month than usual. Officials said that probably accounted for a very sharp drop in unemployment for people in their early 20s. There was also a big drop in unemployment among people over 55. Manufacturing gained 25,000 jobs in August after declines in June and July. 21,000 jobs were created in retail. I'm John Itzde in Washington.
The U.N. Security Council is attempting to reach agreement on a resolution to rebuke Iraq for its offensive into Kurdish areas. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
What has stymied the Security Council is not so much what's in the resolution criticizing Iraq. It's what's not there that's a problem. The resolution expresses grave concern over Iraq's aggression without mentioning the U.S. airstrikes that followed it. Britain, a staunch backer of the U.S. action, is sponsoring the resolution. But other council members, most particularly Russia, are resisting. Russia wants the U.N. to warn against any use of force in the Iraqi crisis. That would be a slap at the U.S. missile attacks. Britain and the United States want to avoid that, but they also don't want a Russian veto of the resolution. So the closed-door negotiations continue. I'm Ann Cooper in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones is up more than 45 points. This is National Public Radio News. Special investigators looking into reports that American troops were exposed to nerve gas during the Persian Gulf War have concluded that as many as 1,100 Americans were exposed to the deadly nerve gas sarin. The exposure occurred after the troops blew up an Iraqi ammunition depot shortly after the war. The investigators work for a special presidential advisory committee on Gulf War veterans' illnesses. Many veterans of that war have suffered from a variety of ailments, which they believe might have been caused by exposure to chemical or biological weapons. New federal rules take effect today requiring the disclosure of information on lead paint in homes that are sold or rented. NPR's David Barron reports.
The new rules stem from a 1992 law aimed at protecting children from the dangers of lead exposure. The law mandates that anyone selling or renting out a dwelling built before 1978 must disclose if lead paint is known to be present. Since 1978, lead paint has been banned for residential use. The law also requires that potential property buyers and renters be given at least 10 days to conduct their own tests for lead paint, and they must be given a pamphlet outlining lead's dangers. The federal law does not require, however, that lead paint be removed. As of today, the federal rules apply only to owners of more than four houses or apartments. Come December, the rules will expand to cover anyone selling or renting out a home. I'm David Barron reporting.
An aide to Ross Perot, who's running for president on the Reform Party ticket, says Perot has picked his running mate, but he won't say yet who it is. James Campbell, who was Perot's boss at IBM, is listed as the vice presidential choice on ballots in some western states. He says it's not him, and he hopes Perot will announce his choice soon so he can officially withdraw. And Perot's stand-in on ballots in the East also says that he has not been contacted. Three people have turned him down. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Eric Lomax has an extraordinary story of how he reconciled with the man who was his worst enemy during World War II. Lomax is a British veteran who was taken prisoner of war by the Japanese in 1942. He and several of his fellow POWs scavenged materials to build a makeshift radio receiver, which they used to monitor news of the war. The guards discovered the receiver, and the men who built it were punished with brutal beatings. Two men were beaten to death. Lomax survived, though most of his limbs were broken. Before he had time to heal, his Japanese captors, believing Lomax was a spy, interrogated and tortured him. The sound of the interrogator's voice haunted Lomax decades after the war ended. But a couple of years ago, he met his tormentor and finally forgave him. Lomax explains how in his memoir, The Railway Man. Terry Gross spoke with Eric Lomax 1 year ago on the 50th anniversary of the Japanese surrender. She asked him what he remembers about the men who presided over his torture.
There were always two men. One was an NCO, a sergeant of the Kempeitai, that is the Japanese military police, and he changed from time to time. I think the Japanese sent for reinforcements when they found they weren't getting results. The second man, a small man, who was there the whole time, possibly for as long a period as 10 days. And he was an interpreter, basically a civilian rather than a soldier, but nevertheless under military discipline. And his job was to carry out the interrogation. He was, of course, an interpreter. He was the only person in that particular group of Japanese who could speak English. So he had to continue soldiering on for a period of somewhere about a week. There was no replacement for him, no reinforcements. So I saw a great deal of him for a period of a week or 10 days.
This is the man who you've since met and forgiven. Tell me a little bit about what he became in your mind, what he started to symbolize to you.
Well, every POW saw hundreds, if not thousands, of Japanese troops at one time or another. And generally speaking, we never saw any one for any particular length of time, with the exception of my interpreter, whom I was very close to indeed for a whole week. So over a period of time, and certainly after the war, the entire Japanese army was practically focused to me through this one particular face, this one particular voice. And, of course, I didn't know his name. I could only visualize him from his appearance and from his voice. It was unusual for any POW to become so close, in the worst sense of the term, with any particular Japanese.
What kind of questions would he ask you, and what kind of threats did he make?
Well, the questions were very wide-ranging, very varied, but they were really aimed at trying to establish that the POWs in my little group were in contact with the Siamese civilians and that we were trying to organise some sort of sabotage or uprising or general insurrection. We, of course, were not, in fact, in contact with them, but this was a very difficult matter to establish. The Japanese wanted to identify a spy, and they tried very hard indeed to establish that it was myself.
So what were the threats that he would give you?
Well, by that time we had all had some very severe beatings. My arms were in splints throughout the whole of the interviews from end to end, and the threats were really directed towards further beatings. And then eventually I was informed that I was going to be killed in any case, so perhaps it would make it easier for myself if I started to talk. In fact, that didn't make any difference in the long run, because if any group of interrogators have a victim with information which they want, the last thing they're going to do is to kill him, because they would lose their source of information.
So in between his interrogation and his threats, you were tortured, you were beaten. There was a water torture also, in which they basically poured water down your nose and down your throat, and you came very close to drowning, and then they'd revive you, bring you back to life for more interrogation and more torture.
Yes, that's correct. That's exactly as it happened. Much of my information about this, strangely enough, comes from a little book written by the interpreter himself, because I think I must have been semi-conscious for part of the time and totally unconscious for part of the time, because the interpreter, whose name I didn't know at that time, has described the whole event in terms which I can't altogether recognize.
Did you ever try to reach him as a fellow human being and you know, just beg him to stop?
I don't think so. I think the nearest I got to that was a little bit of a sidetracking attempt when I decided to ask him about the Japanese educational system. This was intended to waste time and generally deflect their concentration on myself. And he rose to the occasion and started to tell me about the Japanese educational system. And we had quite a bit of a conversation about this. But I could see on his right-hand side the military police NCO getting very restless and restive. And eventually he started to lay into the interpreter, obviously asking him what we were doing, what we were talking about, and so on. And then he told the interpreter that he was supposed to be asking the questions, not me.
Was there ever a moment during the interrogations when you felt that your interrogator was trying to talk to you like a human being?
Very occasionally, yes, but not until we eventually parted company. On the very last day, when my colleagues and I were being put into a Japanese army truck, and of course we had no idea where we were going, I was the last to get on the truck because I had to be assisted, and the interpreter turned to me and said, "Keep your chin up."
Now, I'm going to jump ahead several decades to the late 1980s, when you found out who your anonymous interpreter-interrogator was. How did you find out his identity?
I tried for about 5 years by making inquiries, and then eventually one day, when I was in the middle of my inquiries, I was given a photocopy of a cutting from the Japan Times, dated the 15th of August, 1989. And the cutting showed the photograph of a Japanese with quite a lot of accompanying text, and of course it was in English. I recognised the photograph, and I began to read the text, and within a matter of minutes I'd come to the conclusion that this was a modern photograph of the young man who had been my interrogator. And the text was exceptionally interesting. It gave his name. It quoted his name as Nagase Takashi. I had not heard that name up to that point. And it also explained how the man concerned had suffered terribly, physically and psychologically, during the 40-odd years since the end of the war, how he had been terribly upset by the being involved in the ill-treatment and torture of a British Royal Signals officer. And the whole thing, quite obviously, referred to myself. I just couldn't believe this coincidence. It took quite a little while before it really sunk in that after several years' work, I'd finally identified the man that I was pursuing.
Why were you pursuing him? Why did you want to find him in the first place?
Very hard to explain. Just something that drove me on. I didn't do much about it for the first 40 years after the end of the war. I was busy, like everybody else, earning a living. But when I retired early in the 1980s, I began to pursue him. I had ideas about doing him some harm, and this idea persisted for quite a long time. But eventually, I began to moderate that idea and toned it all down. But it's very hard to explain why I wanted to pursue him, just something that drove me on to try to identify the man who had been such a central feature of my life and ill treatment as a POW.
But your initial motivation was revenge.
Yes. Yes, absolutely right.
So when you read this article from a Japanese paper that said that he was remorseful, did you buy this? Did you believe it?
I took it at face value, but I decided to make a lot of further inquiries. And in fact, I spent well over a year making further inquiries. I got press cuttings, I got magazine articles about the man. I wrote to the British Embassy in Tokyo for further information. Everybody told me the same story, that he appeared to be apologetic, that he seemed to be trying to put things right, that he was opposing Japanese militarism, and that in general terms he was trying to get on with various charitable and other good works, partly in Japan and partly in Thailand.
And what made you decide to actually try to contact him and meet him?
Well, it seemed to be the logical next step, that all the inquiries I made brought satisfactory results. So my wife, Patty, decided to write to him with my full support. So she sent off a letter, and I think the letter must have given Mr. Nagase the most terrible fright, because we discovered afterwards that he had thought I had been dead for many, many years, and to get a letter from the dead must give anyone a little bit of a fright. However, he responded very quickly indeed and wrote the most beautiful letter, full of apologies, full of expressions of remorse, and then we continued the correspondence, and the correspondence continued, not exactly overnight, but with gaps, for a period of well over a year. And we discussed the possibility of having a meeting. And I could see no reason for not having a meeting, so we pressed on, and we eventually met, as is quoted in the book, we eventually met early in 1993 in Thailand.
Terry's guest is Eric Lomax. His memoir is called The Railway Man. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Terry Gross's interview with Eric Lomax. His memoir, The Railway Man, is about the years he was held prisoner of war by the Japanese. He recently met and forgave his interrogator.
I'd like to hear your description of the moment that you met the interpreter who interrogated you.
Well, it was certainly quite remarkable. There has never been another occasion like it in my life, as one can well imagine. We arranged to meet at 10 o'clock on a certain spot, a terrace, not very far from the end of the River Kwai Bridge at Kanchanaburi. I got there first. I saw this small figure approaching, and I recognised him. I'd forgotten just how small he was. I addressed him in Japanese. I just said, "Good morning, how are you?" And he replied in English, expressing his sorrow for what had happened. We shook hands and we went to sit on a nearby seat in the shade, and we talked for perhaps 45 minutes or even an hour, and we talked almost as if we were old friends meeting for the first time after many years' interval. It was really quite remarkable. There was no animosity, no aggression, no difficulty. We even talked about his army pension, and we arranged later on that day to go on a tour around Kanchanaburi to visit some of the important, some of the places which were important during the war.
Did he tell you what it was like to be in his shoes with the assignment of interrogating you?
Yes, he explained how unhappy he had been, how he was compelled to follow his orders, what a terrible situation he and his family would have been in if he had disobeyed. And he even told me at one point that he was reprimanded by his superiors in the military police for not being fierce enough with me.
Over 45 years had elapsed between the time that he interrogated you and the time that you met him again. Were there questions you had stored up over the years? You know, if I ever get to meet him, this is what I would ask.
Yes, you're quite right. There were quite a number of things that I had stored up, and I never really got answers to them, I think quite genuinely, because Mr. Ningassi was not in a position to answer them. I wanted to know who had given the orders for the search which led to the discovery of the radios. I wanted to know why they suspected we had a radio at all. And I wanted to know about the fate of the military police NCOs who had interrogated me sitting beside Mr. Ningassi. And I couldn't get answers to any of these questions. I think Mr. Ningassi quite genuinely didn't know. But one curious side issue came to the surface, and that was that the Japanese regarded me as a bit of a prize catch. And they brought Mr. Ningassi specially from Saigon in Indochina to Kanchanaburi in Thailand in order to interrogate me, because they didn't think they had anybody available locally who was a sufficiently good interpreter. And another thing I discovered was that I was apparently the only POW questioned by Mr. Ningassi. He was transferred to other duties immediately after he had finished with me. This was quite important because it meant that for the rest of his life, the ill effects of that ill treatment and that torture could be attributable to his confrontation with myself.
Right, when he thought about the torture, you were the victim. You
yes.
You were the only victim that he
yes.
was responsible for. So you were as important in his mind as he was in yours, in a way.
Absolutely, yes, this is perfectly true.
Did you get a sense of what transformed him?
Yes, he explained how he was a devout Buddhist, and he required forgiveness, not only for purposes of this life, but for purposes of the future life. He explained how he had understood that I had died many, many years before, and that this upset his long-term prospects, and certainly his prospects in the future world. So he was particularly glad that I had survived, particularly glad that we were having meetings and having conversations, and quite obviously, he wanted my forgiveness. And there now developed a little bit of a cultural problem, because he understood that my appearance at Kanchanaburi in our meeting and our discussion constituted forgiveness. And he told me that this was the happiest day of his life. These were his exact words. In fact, I had not forgiven him at that point, and I hadn't given him any indication that I had. I carried forward the idea that I might forgive him, but I wanted to have further conversations, further discussions with him. After all, we'd planned to spend somewhere about a further 3 weeks together, and I certainly had not forgiven him at that first point. But Mr. Ningassi thought I had forgiven him, so we had to sort that out.
When did you forgive him?
About 3 weeks later, shortly before we were due to leave Tokyo. Mr. and Mrs. Ningassi and my wife and I were in next-door bedrooms in a hotel in Tokyo, and I decided at that point, after 3 weeks of further conversation and contact with Ningassi, I decided that I could in fact forgive him. So I wrote him out a carefully worded letter of forgiveness, which I thought would meet his Buddhist requirements, quite apart from his day-to-day requirements, and I arranged to have a little private meeting with him one morning in his bedroom, gave him this letter, went over it word by word to make sure that he understood every word of it, and he was absolutely delighted. And I have never had the slightest reason to doubt his honesty or his integrity or his authenticity. I think he is absolutely genuine, and I stand by that forgiveness that I gave him.
What did you say in the letter?
Well, I'd have to quote from memory. It is, in fact, in the book, but I explained that he was taking too much of the entire guilt of the Japanese nation on his own shoulders, that he was quite right to oppose militarism, that I personally was quite satisfied with his post-war life, his post-war career, that he had demonstrated his regret at what happened in 1943, that I understood he was acting under orders, and I was quite happy to give him forgiveness.
How has offering forgiveness to your interrogator changed you and changed your dreams even?
Well, I think one almost has to ask other people that, but so far as I can answer the question, it lifts a burden, it lightens one's load. And almost going off at a slight tangent, I can see no point in perpetuating hatefulness or bitterness, because it doesn't do any harm to the person that one is hating. It just pulls down the person who is being hateful and bitter. But it's very hard to generalize about this. It's so much a personal matter.
Did meeting Mr. Nagase give you more hope about the human condition?
Yes, yes, but only in a very, very small way.
Right, a select few.
Yes. After all, there are only two of us, as distinct from millions of other people. But yes, it does suggest that it is possible for two people with goodwill to become reconciled. And I would certainly take pleasure in meeting Mr. Nagase again.
I thank you so much for sharing some of your story with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Terry Groves speaking with Eric Lomax. Eric Lomax's memoir, The Railway Man, is out in paperback. The book is being made into a television film by the BBC. I'm Barbara Bulgave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hey, Paul, can you turn around and watch me?
Yeah.
Do, do, do. Jesus is calling.
Okay, gotcha, Cassandra.
Coming up, the life and music of Sam Cooke. Before he became a soul singer, Cooke sang and produced gospel. This is a 1959 session he produced with the gospel group, the Soul Stirrers.
Telling you the way.
Jesus is calling.
Wait in the Lord.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave.
Darling, you send me. I know you send me. Darling, you send me. Honest you do, honest you do, honest you do.
You Send Me is the name of Daniel Wolfe's biography of the late Sam Cooke, written in cooperation with Cooke's close associate, S.R. Crane. It investigates the circumstances behind Cooke's mysterious death over 30 years ago. At the age of 33, Cooke was shot through the heart in a seedy motel room. Sam Cooke is best remembered for his soul hits You Send Me, Only 16, Chain Gang, Cupid, Twistin' the Night Away, and Shake. He started his career in a teenage gospel group. When he was 19, he was picked by S.R. Crane to replace the retiring lead singer of the Soul Stirrers, the legendary R.H. Harris. Terry Gross spoke with Daniel Wolfe and S.R. Crane last spring. Their book is now out in paperback. This is The Soul Stirrers, with Sam Cooke singing lead.
Lord, up there, I'll meet my mother. Lord, up there, I'll meet my mother. Saint and joy, bed, rain and glory. Lord, I fall from my from Canaan. Lord, when I get on home, my Savior, I join. Well, I shout, God knows I'm going to dwell. Shout, hey, Lord, God knows I want to know I fall from my.
What was it like to have Sam Cooke in the Soul Stirrers? Since he was younger than the other members of the band, did he behave differently? And
yep.
Yeah,
he
what was the difference?
A lot different.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing, you could never get him up in the morning on time, and he's always late. And I devised a plan to get him there on time. If the program was at 8 o'clock, I'd tell him it's 7, and so maybe we'll get him there on time. He had all of that. But whenever he got there, he ruled the roost, as we call it.
Mr. Crane, am I right that when he started singing with the Soul Stirrers, younger people in the audience, especially women people, started coming forward in the congregation the way they hadn't with Harris?
Oh, I'll tell you the truth. This is a wonderful thing. I noticed in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, I told my bass singer then, Jesse Farley, I said, Jay, did you see all these people? They didn't go to Archie Brownlee. That was one of the blind boys. They didn't go to Kyle O'Turner, and that was the Pilgrim Trail. I said, they came to Sam. And Father said, yep, I noticed him. I said, yeah, well, this must be the man. And the young people the young people used to sit in the back. But when Sam started singing, the young people came to the front. And we pushed Sister Flute in the back. And that's the older people. So we call her Sister Flute. We don't call nobody's name. And the young people push Sister Flute in the back when Sam started singing. But now when R.H. Harris was singing, Sister Flute was in the front, and she pushed the young people in the back. And
so
that's kind of the difference.
Do you think this actually brought young people closer to God or just closer to Sam Cooke?
I don't know. I'm not going to try to answer that. I don't know.
It's certainly worth looking at the fact that over in the secular world, the teenagers was being, quote-unquote, invented around this time, so that for the Platters and the Dominoes and Elvis Presley, there was something similar going on.
Daniel Wolfe, why do you think Sam Cooke wanted to cross over from gospel music to pop?
Well, you should ask me that.
Okay, I'll ask you that, Mr. Crane.
Go ahead, Mr. Crane.
The reason Sam had wanted to cross over to pop, he'd gone as far as he could go in gospel. See, gospel only paid that little 10 and 15 cents that we was getting in those days. And Sam wanted to better his condition.
So you think it was for money?
Well, it was partly for money, yes. He wanted some money. He wanted the nice things. He wanted fine cars that he see. And I wanted them too.
What about the music? Did he particularly want to sing pop music?
Yeah, he wanted to. He wanted to sing it. You didn't have to urge him, because he had sense, he had the knowledge, he had the speech, he had the training, and it just fit Sam Cooke.
Now, did he tell you that this is what he wanted and almost like ask for your permission or...
Yes, he asked for my opinion.
What'd you tell him?
I told him, no, stay in Soul Stirrers. Because I couldn't see no further than Soul Stirrers.
Mm-hmm.
You understand?
Oh, sure.
And of course, he could see further than me because he had a better education than I had. As you can see now, my education is limited, very limited. But my knowledge, but my wisdom is very high. My wisdom is sky high.
Amen.
I ain't joking with you.
When Sam first thought about crossing over into rock and roll or pop, he tried to do it halfway. He cut a single as Dale Cooke.
Yeah.
Thinking that might fool somebody. Of course, there he was yodeling and sounding just like the man everybody knew, and I don't think it fooled anybody.
And he didn't fool nobody.
Well, I'd like to play the song that made him famous as a pop singer.
You Send Me, Me.
You Send Me, yeah. And in fact, what I'd like to do is play the demo of the song. I think he sounds great on this. It's just Sam Cooke and guitar. In fact, is that him playing guitar or is it somebody else?
No, that was Cliff White playing the guitar.
Okay.
A lot of folks thought it was Sam playing the guitar, but that was Cliff White. That's reason Cliff White is a part of us now. He played every song that Sam sang.
Cliff White, who's one of the collaborators on this book You Send Me, talked about Sam coming in to sing it for him the first time, and he said, I sat there with my guitar, and Sam taught me the chords. I started playing it, and he sung You Send Me about six times, and I thought, well, that's not too interesting. And then he got to the second verse, and the second verse was nothing but saying You Send Me over and over again, another six times. And Cliff said, this song isn't going anywhere. This one's a total failure. He ended up eating his words.
That's right.
Why don't we hear the demo of You Send Me? And this is actually featured now on a new box set CD called The Sar Story, and it's the recordings that Sam Cooke released on his own record label, a record label we'll talk about in a bit.
Okay.
This is You Send Me.
Send me when I see you, you send me whenever I hold you, you send me, honest you do. At first I thought it was infatuation, but ooh, it's lasted so long. And now I find myself wanting to marry you and take you home, because when I'm with you, you...
Daniel Wolfe, who was this demo made for?
This was made for Art Roop and the owner of Specialty Records, where he had sung gospel, and for Bumps Blackwell, who was the producer of the record. What ended up happening was he came into the studio to cut this record on a day that Art Roop was supposed to be elsewhere. And Bumps Blackwell had brought in some white backup singers. Bumps and Sam were determined not only to get out of gospel, but to leap right over R&B and end up in the pop market, which is to say the market that appealed to both whites and blacks, and therefore a much larger audience. Art Roop didn't particularly believe in that kind of music. He had major hits with Little Richard, which was a much harder sound. And when he saw the white backup singers and heard the sort of lilting sound of You Send Me, he went off. And he as much as threw Bumps and Sam out of the studio.
That's right.
They picked up the demo and headed across town and eventually signed with a tiny little label called Keen, which is the label that had the hit. And as Art Roop said later, I've been in mourning ever since. I've been wearing black ever since.
That's right.
Well, Daniel, as you point out, this was a time when it was very difficult for most black artists to cross over into the, you know, white parts of radio and record sales. Did Sam Cooke have any trouble doing that?
Well, he didn't have trouble with You Send Me, in other words, in terms of rock and roll, which was still considered a sort of mongrel music. He then, though, tried to play the Copacabana. He wanted to get into the nightclub scene as well, because there you could sell albums, and you made a lot more money on them than you did on 45s. But the first time he played the Copa, where he sang songs like Putting On My Top Hat and that sort of thing, he was a total bomb. The orchestra was going one direction, he was going another direction. The audience couldn't have cared less, and it took him a long time to get over that and to come back, and he finally did and triumphed at the Copa, but it was 6 years, 5 years later.
Mr. Cream, what was it like for you at the Copa? What did you think of the world of nightclubs?
Well, actually, by the time we got to the Copa, we had sang at Town Hill, and we had sang at the Elegante, and we'd made it, and so we begged Larry Auerbach at the agency to come out and hear us, because we knew we could get back in the Copa. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, I kind of differed with Daniel when you say he was a bum. Sam was just singing, and he did all right. But what the reason what that Sam didn't take it to Copa, it was they had a storyteller by the name of Myron Cohen.
The Borscht Belt comic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And the people that came to see Myron Cohen was old people. And, of course, Sam Cooke sang his heart out then. I knew he was singing. He knew he was singing then. He knew he was good enough. But the people that come to hear Myron Cohen was 50s and 60s, and Sam's a kid coming on there singing, Lord, You Send Me, and all that kind of mess.
Oh, sure.
And that's it signed to them.
Myron Cohen was the kind of comic whose punchlines were mostly in Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
So
it was. All
he attracted an audience of older people who knew
right.
Yiddish and who would not know who Sam Cooke was or
never
probably
heard
care
of Sam
much.
Cooke.
That's interesting.
Terry's guests are Daniel Wolfe and S.R. Crane. Their biography of Sam Cooke, You Send Me, is out in paperback. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
She was only 16. I loved her so, but she was 16. Too young to fall 16. In love, and I was too young to know. We'd laugh and 16. We'd sing and do the 16. Little things that made my heart.
Back with Terry's interview with Daniel Wolfe and S.R. Crane. Their biography of Sam Cooke is called You Send Me.
Daniel, here's a question for you.
Okay.
When Sam Cooke started singing pop, do you feel you hear a lot of gospel influence in his voice? And I'm wondering if you could maybe choose one of his pop records that you think has a particular connection to one of his gospel records.
Well, I think part of the development of Sam Cooke was there was always the gospel in his voice, but the longer he did rock and roll, and the more confident he became, the more he let that out. By the time you get to a song like Bring It On Home to Me, later in his career, he was being much more upfront, I think, about his gospel roots. And he was singing on that particular song with the young Lou Rawls, singing those yeahs back and forth.
Yes.
And that's call and response. I mean, that's getting Sister Flute. It's almost indistinguishable from gospel music. At the beginning...
That's right.
At the beginning, tunes like Wonderful World or I'll Come Running Back to You are much, he's being much more careful about sounding not white, but sounding not heavy black gospel, because he was trying to get the market.
Well, why don't we hear Bring It On Home to Me?
Great.
If you ever change your mind about leaving me behind, oh, bring it to me, bring your sweet loving, bring it on home to me, yeah,
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 yeah. ahead, well, or go backwards, depending on where we are in the story. Let's go to 1959, when Sam Cooke and you, Mr. Crane, and a third partner founded SAR Records, and the R was for your middle name.
That's right. Senior Roy is my name.
Yeah, and the S was
the
for
R
Sam.
R is Roy. So, S for Sam, Alex, and Roy.
Daniel Wolfe, you describe SAR Records as Sam Cooke's idea of the civil rights movement put into practice. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, one of the quotes in the book is from a friend of Sam's called Harold Batiste, who said, "If this is our music, why don't we own it?"
It
strikes me as still an important question.
It really is.
And SAR music was Sam saying, I don't always want to sing for someone else and just get a percentage of it. I want to own this business. He already owned the publishing for his songs, which was semi-revolutionary for the time. A lot of artists didn't, and a lot of artists regret it to this day because they don't have the money.
That's right.
But Sam owned his publishing, and SAR was a kind of extension of that. It was both, he hoped, a way when he couldn't sing anymore, or wasn't a teen idol, to stay in the music business. And while he was still singing, it was a way to try out ideas. So he would go there, and for example, the Sims twins were a duet who were the sort of model for Sam and Dave. And he brought them in to help sing back up on Cupid. And while they were in there, he said, I have this song called Soothe Me. Would you try recording that? They did. It was a big hit. And Sam could see that he could stay on the other side of the recording studio and turn the dials and have some say in the product as well.
Had Sam Cooke been having problems with his labels, besides the fact that he didn't own the publishing, was he asked to do things that he didn't really want to do? Did he want more control over his material or the presentation?
Well, I tell you, this is that's a question that's hard to answer. But he didn't have any trouble. It's just some things he would do and some things he wouldn't.
Mr. Crane,
you don't care who he was.
Crane is being nice now. He's being very nice. In my opinion, he did have some trouble. I mean,
I'm a nice fellow.
You are a nice fellow. I'm just nice sometimes. He went from Specialty Records, where he had this fight over You Send Me with Art Rube, to Keen Records, which was this tiny label. And at Keen, Sam frankly didn't think he was getting the money that he should have been getting, as I understand it.
You're right.
He then went to RCA, and one of the troubles he had with RCA was they had the only other African-American artist on the label at the time, I believe, was Harry Belafonte.
Right.
And they had a real clear idea of what a black singer ought to be singing, and it wasn't Sam Cooke music.
That's right.
So the first song, for example, he released was Teenage Sonata, which, if you haven't heard of it, it's for a good reason. It is a terrible song and a terrible record. He had cut already Chain Gang, which they delayed 6 months releasing, I think because they felt it was too soulful, believe it or not, for RCA's image. When they did release it, it was a massive hit.
That's right.
So he wanted more control.
Yep.
Daniel Wolfe is the author of You Send Me, The Life and Times of Sam Cooke, written in cooperation with S.R. Crane. It won the Ralph J. Gleason Music Book Award this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
I hear something saying, chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying, huh. Ah. Huh. Ah. Huh. Ah. Huh. Ah.
Well, don't you know?
That's the sound of the men working on the chain.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with Sam Cooke biographer Daniel Wolfe and S.R. Crane.
Sam Cooke was killed at the age of 33 in 1964. He was shot through the heart and bludgeoned on the head, I believe, found in just an overcoat and one shoe in a sleazy motel. What was the official story of what happened?
The official story was that he had abducted a woman in order to rape her. She had escaped, and in searching for her, he'd broken down the door and been shot by the motel manager.
And why do you think of that as just the official story? Do you think that there's a true story that is different?
Yes.
Why?
Well, if you look for one thing, simply at the testimony at the inquest, which was a very hurried affair, it's rife with contradictions. No one seems to be able to quite get their story straight about this. As it turns out, the woman he took to the motel was arrested for prostitution a month later. Certainly a bunch of Sam Cooke's friends, as is first revealed in this book, say he knew the motel, Sam, and that he probably knew the woman. There are a lot of holes in the story that don't hold up. Among other things, I should add, there are a couple of people's testimony in here who saw him with quite a lot of money at the beginning of the evening, which he did not have by the end of the evening, and which provides a different motive and certainly a different spin on this story, I think.
So do you think the possibility is that he was robbed and murdered, or do you think there's something even more mysterious that happened?
I think he was robbed. That's my guess, and I think his clothes were taken when he was robbed, and I think in pursuing that, he ended up at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mr. Crane, what do you think?
Well, I really can't. One thing I knew Sam. And by saying that Sam wanted to rape him, about the biggest lie that could ever been told. And he wouldn't rape nobody because I had to hire people to keep women off of him. He wouldn't rape nobody. And that's the big lie. And, of course, I didn't have enough money to track it down. If I'd have had it, I would have. But I just didn't have enough money. And then I knew better than to try to track up a lie. If you go to track a lie down, you lose everything you got. You lose all your money. You lose all your power. You lose all everything. So I just sat back because I know the man upstairs is going to straighten this thing. And you got to let him have it. That's my version of it.
Can I put something in here, Terry?
Yeah.
Yes.
One of the sad things in terms of Sam's career about when he died was he had just recorded and released a song called The Change Is Going to Come.
And that's right.
And if there was ever a moment when gospel music met pop music in a beautiful meeting, it is that song, which I think is as intelligent and moving a discussion of the civil rights movement and the history of African Americans in this country as we have in music. It's a great, great song.
Well, I think it's a beautiful note to end on. I thank you both enormously for talking with us. Thank you, Daniel Wolfe. Thank you, S.R. Crane.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You Send Me, The Life and Times of Sam Cooke, won the Ralph J. Gleason Music Book Award this year. It's out in paperback.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the moon.
Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Interviews and reviews on Fresh Air are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Alan Tu, with Tracy Tannenbaum. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Siobhan Roth. Audrey Bentham is technical director. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Dancing to the music played by the DJ on the radio. The Cokes are in the icebox, popcorn's on the table. Me and my baby, we're out here on the floor. So Mr. DJ, keep those records playing, 'cause I'm having such a good time dancing with my baby. Everybody's swinging. Sally's doing that twist now.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.